Hi, and welcome to Police Stories Podcast. This is episode 76, a series of short stories about my 28-year career in the UK Police Force. Welcome if this is your first time, and welcome back if you've been here before. Hopefully you've been enjoying the series. We've done quite a bit of variety, I think, one way or another. Thanks very much again for the downloads this week. Been fantastic again. It just keeps increasing, which is great and still very unbelievable to me. And when you look certainly at the spread of where the downloads are across the world, I can see sort of where they're being downloaded. It's amazing. You know, it's Whangarei, you know, in New Zealand and Australia, you know, New York, India, you know, Canada, France, lots in the UK, but it never ceases to amaze me the sort of far-flung places that are downloading and hopefully enjoying the podcast. I hope that the sound goes okay again today. I'm back in the motorhome as I normally am, but I'm in a car park basically in Portugal, so I've tried to pick a quiet location. I hope we don't get noise throughout. We'll see how that goes. If we do, then depending on how bad it is, I'll probably just carry on because I'm not clever enough to actually edit anything out. I just kind of record it and that's it, you know. You get what you get, hopefully. So we'll get started this week. So I'm back in Scotland, Police Scotland, and I've transferred up from the Met, as you know, if you've been listening along, and I'm back on response. So, you know, the at the sharp end, if you like, dealing with anything and everything that comes in. This one today, quite an interesting backstory. Gets pretty gruesome, I'll warn you now. And perhaps, depending on your take of comedy, a slightly bit of comedy twist in here as well. But see what you think. You might just think I'm sick in the head, perhaps. I don't know. But you don't do my job in my role or roles for as long as I did without getting a bit of a twisted sense of humour. So this call came in, like most others, very straightforward. Just reports of a sudden death in a location, and this was a remote sort of cottage that was overlooking a large loch on the west of Scotland. You know, no neighbours, set up a steep hill, opened out into a driveway, a small bungalow, but set in the woods. A lovely location for sure, and a sudden death, which comes in virtually all the time to police, certainly pretty much daily, I would suggest, anywhere. And you might say, well, why do police get called to all these deaths? And the reality is, certainly in the UK, they get called because there's a need to record them for either the coroner or the procurator fiscal in Scotland. They're the ones that sort of decide on the causes of death. And I'm sure this is probably repeated maybe with, you know, different phrases and acronyms and words throughout the world. There's a need to investigate a death unless a doctor is willing to sign the death certificate. So, for example, somebody who has cancer, say, and it's an expected medical death, then the doctor who's perhaps seen the patient within 2 weeks will sign that death certificate to say they have died of cancer, it was expected, and then there's no sort of investigation or police involvement, really. Sometimes we still get called, but invariably that tends to go straight to the ambulance and is dealt with in a very straightforward way. Anyone else who dies, certainly in the UK, there will probably be a police involvement, albeit it might be very basic. And that's, you know, where your response cop comes in, who, as I say, gets called to anything. So this, as I say, was a sudden death call. And in fact, a traffic car, the guys and girls that deal with, you know, the offences on the roads, the speeding, the nasty accidents, you know, and the safety stuff, they happen to be nearby. And certainly where I worked, it was such a small place with so few officers, you couldn't really sort of, you know, be too precious about, I'm a traffic officer, I don't go to that, I'm a response officer, I don't go to that. You know, you pretty much everyone went to everything and helped each other out. That's how it had to work. It would not have worked otherwise. So traffic got there first, and they immediately called up for a supervisor, a sergeant, which is not unusual for a sudden death. But you certainly got the impression from the sort of update they'd given that there was perhaps a little bit more to this one. So the sergeant went along, and in fact, I was with him. We went along to this location, and when we got there, the first issue was there was two dogs at the location. So you went through a gate that opened out into a sort of paved area where the house was, and the gate contained the dogs. Now, the dogs, one was like a big black kind of Alsatian, quite a big, you know, sort of mean looking dog. And the other one was a small white fluffy thing. I'm not entirely sure what kind of make and model it was, possibly like a Bichon Frise or something like that, but certainly didn't give you the impression it would give you too much trouble. Whereas the big black thing looked like it meant business and was barking sort of furiously as we approached. The traffic guys had obviously got past that dog initially, I think, to get into the house. I'm not entirely sure whether they'd gone in to the house at that point or maybe just got to the entrance. I'm not 100% clear on that. But certainly we turned up, the dogs came rushing up to the gate and we kind of tried to, you know, talk to them and sort of try and gauge how they were. We had to get in there, but we were a bit concerned that obviously we were going to get bitten in the process. The one dog, the big black one, had a what looked like a tree branch in its mouth, you know, a fairly thin sort of branch, like a stick, you know, and it looked like it had, I don't know, been chewing on it or, you know, picked it up for whatever reason. I assumed perhaps it was playing with it or something, you know. So we managed to talk the dogs enough that we built up our courage to go through the gate and kind of move slowly and, you know, bent down, no eye contact, and tried to get the dogs to come over for a stroke. And they were a bit cautious about us, but they did come over. And although they were barking occasionally, they didn't sort of attack us, thankfully. And in fact, this dog, the big black one, came up with this twig in its mouth or branch or whatever it was and sort of offered it up to me, you know. So I took hold of it and had a little game of, you know, sort of tug of war with it, and then threw it across the you know, the sort of driveway, and it ran off and picked it up and brought it back. So I did that a couple of times, and in fact I think the dog then ended up leaving it, you know, and sort of, you know, coming with us, and then the dogs kind of disappeared off into the garden somewhere because it was quite a big plot. So we carried on round to the back door of the premises, and I think they were insecure, and when I say that, I mean they were unlocked. You know, no one had smashed the back door down. There was no signs of a forced entry. I think the property was unlocked when we got there. But as soon as we got to the back of the location, you got the smell. You know, now sudden death generally smell of varying levels. Now, what made this one much worse than most was the person was believed to have been in there, not been seen for 3 or 4 months, I believe. So quite a long time, and it was now kind of August, height of summer certainly, and I think this particular day was 25, maybe 28 degrees, something like that. It was very, very hot, particularly for Scotland, you know, very unusually so, because it's rare to get those temperatures in Scotland. So it was absolutely boiling. The other thing that was out in force was the midges at that location, because they love kind of woods and they love, you know, water and locks and things. So it was a terrible location for midges. What you really need is a breeze to sort of keep them away. But we'll talk about those in a bit more detail, because they're a real feature in Scotland. You know, they're something you do have to take into account within policing, unbelievably, because they can be so bad. So we went to the back of the property, and I think the sergeant went in first without me initially, but fairly quickly came out and said, you know, can you come in with me on this one, have a look, this is pretty bad, you know. And he knew my background, he knew that I'd come from the marine unit, so I was used to sort of bringing, you know, fairly decomposed bodies out of the river, etc. So he said, yeah, come and have a look with me. We opened the door and the smell just almost knocked me off my feet. You know, I was pretty used to this stuff, but it was horrendous. And when we got into the house, you knew it had been a long time, because not only was there thousands, and I mean thousands, of flies everywhere, which you unfortunately get. I think there's somebody, you know, I'm sure you can Google this, but I think they say like flies can smell a corpse from like 3 miles away or something, and generally make, you know, to it, because they want to lay their eggs in it, you know, because it's a good place for them to thrive, which of course then turn into maggots, which you can imagine brings up all sorts of horrific pictures, unfortunately, and things that you see when you go to these ones. So there was thousands of flies sort of flying around, but there was also literally thousands of flies dead on the floor, and kind of chrysalis, which is that, you know, the dead maggots. There was a load of beetles on the floor. So as we were walking in, kind of crunching our way across the floor, and it was, I've never seen anything quite like it, to be honest with you, and this ended up being the worst one that I ever went to. So combined with, you know, the heat, because bearing in mind this property had now been closed up for months, no windows open at all, and what we then found in the bedroom was that the gas fire in there had been on sort of full blast. So it had been artificially heating the place with this heat outside, the windows shut. So you might ask, well, how did the flies get in? I don't know. They always do. They always find a way in. And from there, as I say, just a horrendous scene. You know, went into the bedroom. And the guy, although to be honest with you, at this point, we couldn't really tell if it was a guy or a girl. The body was on the bed. And what happens with bodies when they've been left a long time, they start off as whole bodies like you or me, you know, and look, you know, no different apart from going a bit pale, really. And then as time goes on, eventually the decomposition process takes hold and the bodies bloat and they swell up. And that's why if they're in water after a period of time, and that varies depending on the temperature of the water, ranging from in the summer, it can be kind of a week, to the winter, it could be 3 weeks. When their bodies, you know, bloat up and expand and fill with gases, they then float to the surface, which is why bodies quite often come to the surface. That same thing happens no matter where you die. And that's what would happen with this. Now, unfortunately, eventually the body effectively splits somewhere, which releases the gases, which you can imagine only adds with to the, you know, the smell and the sights. And then, you know, unfortunately, if you add in the flies and various other sort of insects all, you know, having a go, basically, it's a pretty horrendous scene. And then as time goes on, and I'm sure there's, you know, some sort of scientific term for this, but I can only tell you from my point of view what you see. The skin and fat of the body then, I told you this was getting gruesome, sorry, effectively melts into the skeleton, if you like. So over time, all the features of the person, all the fats and the skin just melt into the skeleton. And obviously left long enough, you know, there will be nothing but a skeleton left. All the internal organs, the same thing, kind of rot and just decompose and sort of leak out everywhere. And this is pretty much what we were faced with. You know, we knew what turned out to be a he had been there a long time, and he'd effectively, you know, kind of melted into the bed and leaked, you know, over the bed. So the bed was just a pool of, you know, fluid and bones and skin, you know. I mean, it was really, really unpleasant. I'm trying to describe it for you. And the smell, you know, was just unbelievable. It was all you could do to stand in there. And I say, I'm pretty used to it. And I know you see in the detective shows, you know, they put a bit of, smelling salts and various things, you know, Vicks up their nose to sort of take the smell away. I've never actually seen a real cop do that. I think that's something, you know, for the TV. But it's, you just can't get away from the smell. And even it can, if you stand in there long enough, you know, it can literally impregnate your clothes. You know, you can take your clothes off later, your uniform off later, and you can still smell it. You can smell it on your skin, you know, prior to having a shower. It, you know, it can be very, very bad, very unpleasant. And this was certainly one of those. Now, the next stage then, because we knew nothing about this guy's background, we didn't know anything about how this had happened. You know, was it natural causes? Maybe, you know, no sign of a forced entry. The sergeant was there and he was in charge of that initial investigation and sort of evidence gathering. Quite often, before we know what's happened at something like this, we'll start a scene log, or a locus, as they call it in Scotland. So you would record everyone who's entered that property. You might write out in your notes kind of which way they walked into the property, because if a footprint or something is found later, you know, and you say, well, actually, I came around the back and came through the side door, obviously that might immediately explain that footprint. But, you know, we're kind of, being cops, we're instantly thinking, you know, suspiciously that this could be a sudden, you know, more than a sudden death. This could be a murder, you know, and we need to rule that out. And until we do, we don't want to go tromping across everything. Now, later on, you generally don't go into these scenes and they're left for forensics to come in. But of course, initially, you know, the response cops, somebody has to go in there and actually establish what you've got. Because I've had reports of sudden deaths before. And when you go in, the person's actually still alive, for example, if it's recent. You know, and there's been some sort of CPR work required and things. So you have to, as a cop, go in initially. But once you've been in once and you've tried to disturb those things as little as you can, you would then come out, kind of seal it up and start this scene log. And then you would, you know, call in the detectives who would then call in forensics. And that's basically what happened. So the sergeant reported up the chain, you know, we've got this deceased male. looks like he's been here long term, no signs of a forced entry, but that doesn't necessarily mean anything, particularly in rural Scotland, because in certain places, I can tell you, very few people lock their doors. So that wouldn't be unusual and wouldn't necessarily instantly sort of rule things out. And of course, you could then bring in all elements that, if he was murdered, it could have been by somebody who knew him, who had a key. So you can't sort of assume anything. And that's the key point, kind of everything is on the table at that point. All the options are open. And that's really what the detectives do when they come in. Well, as time went on, we found out a bit more about the background of this guy. And there's quite an interesting backstory to him, which enhanced our concern that this may be a suspicious death initially. And we were definitely right to treat it as such. So in the 1980s in Glasgow, there was something called the Ice Cream Wars, which might make you chuckle, but, from everything I've read and heard about from other cops, they were nothing to laugh about for sure. So in the UK, you have ice cream vans, and they drive around the streets and they play like a jingly jangly music that attracts the children. Every now and then they stop on a street corner and all the children come over and they then sell them, drinks, ice cream, crisps and all those sorts of things. And as a young kid, I remember kind of running around the streets, you'd hear the ice cream van tinkling its music, you come running out and or run in first to go and see mum and dad and, can I have some money? Here comes the ice cream van, I'd like a lolly or whatever. And that happens throughout the UK. Certainly it used to happen a lot more, probably not quite so much now, but it was a big thing. Well, in the 80s, that was also happening in Glasgow. And unfortunately, those who do kind of organised crime figured out that it was a very easy way of having good access to all sorts of people, on the street, not just children, but also adults as well. And it was a very good way of travelling around and actually selling both drugs and stolen goods and all sorts of, criminal elements came into it and realised they could sell everything from, stolen gear to weapons to drugs. But it seemed to be mainly centred on drugs, is my understanding. So each of these ice cream vans had a round, if you like, a bit like a postman. They'd have an area that they would work. And this was such a lucrative business. There started to be turf wars over who sort of controlled the individual rounds, the ice cream rounds. So, they were selling so many drugs and stolen gear, both selling and buying from these ice cream vans. It became so lucrative that now rival gangs were trying to encroach on other people's areas or convince the driver to now start selling drugs for them, and of course, that created, a large amount of violence. In the 80s, Glasgow was a very, very violent place anyway. And certain areas were particularly bad. So you had these rival gangs, and what was happening was that the gangs were approaching the drivers, trying to convince them to work for them. Depending on, who had the biggest gang or the most violent gang, either the drivers would agree to do that, or ultimately, they may say no, but then chances are there was going to be violence and threats levelled at them. So there was a lot of violent attacks on drivers and also within the gangs. It really did spark off a big sort of turf war, to the point that this one particular round that was very, very lucrative was run by one guy and one gang particularly. Another gang tried to encroach on it. Initially approached a driver and he basically said, I'm not getting involved, I'm having nothing to do with it. I work for so-and-so, and I'm staying with them. He probably knew that if he decided he was going to sort of change sides, that he was in for at best a kicking, and if not, worse, perhaps he was going to get stabbed. And sure enough, he was physically attacked some weeks later and still wouldn't sort of turn, if you like, and work for the others. So this then moved on to the point that a few weeks later, he was actually shot through the windscreen of his ice cream van with a shotgun and was hit and injured. But he still wouldn't turn and carried on working for this one individual. And again, this carried on until, the rumours go, and depending on what you read online and various court cases, it was decided that they would put a frightener on him, basically try and scare him. And somebody went to his address and basically put like a petrol bomb, certainly a lit rag with petrol, through his letterbox with a view to starting, I guess, a small fire, as this frightener, this warning to him that what was going to happen if he didn't come and work for this other group. Well, unfortunately, it went terribly wrong and the fire really took hold, and there was a lot of people asleep in that flat. Six people died in the fire. I think it was five initially, and a sixth person died later in the hospital. So there was, and this is in the 80s, don't forget. I mean, there would be sort of shock at this point in a community anywhere if that happened. But I think at the time, it was massive, massive news in Glasgow. And obviously, there was a huge sort of murder investigation set up. Well, ultimately, two people were arrested and charged, and then went to court and got convicted at court of the murders, the six murders of these people. And then they got life imprisonment, which at the time they were told they served 20 years in prison because of it. So they served, and that was in 84, I believe, 1984. So they served a fair bit of time. They were in prison for a long time and kept appealing it, but never got anywhere with it. And ultimately, I think on the third appeal, the Court of Appeal ruled that it was an unsafe conviction, and the two guys that were convicted originally of those six murders were released from prison. And the reason I'm telling you this is because the man that we'd found deceased was one of those men. He was quite well known in the Glasgow sort of criminal circles, and he had a background of assault convictions, of firearms offences. He'd shot someone and served, I think, 10 years in prison already. So he had quite a big history. So you can imagine when we then found out who this was, it upped it massively as to how we were going to deal with it and possibly why he'd come to die in the first place. Just out of interest, on the appeal, there were sort of three main pieces of evidence, and I think one of them was ruled that the intimation was that the police had planted a piece of evidence in his house to make sure he got convicted. Now, whether that's true or not, I don't know. But certainly there was a witness that they managed to discredit that had overheard somebody, these two guys speaking in a pub, I think, saying they were going to put a frightener on this guy, and torch his house to sort of scare him off. That was one of the pieces of evidence. There was, I think, a piece of a map book that was marked with this person's address, and that was found in one of our two sort of suspects' home addresses. So that was one of the other pieces of evidence that sort of convicted him. But I don't know, more than that really in terms of the court cases, but I do know that this is our man now that's deceased in this house. So obviously, it took a little bit of time to figure this out. The suggestion was that he'd moved now, out of those circles. I think he was in his mid-60s at this point. He'd moved out of those criminal circles was the suggestion, and that he'd basically bought this cottage, in the middle of nowhere, kind of overlooking a lock, and kept himself to himself. But of course, we were very aware that someone like that with that background, particularly around those murders, because he'd been found, sort of not guilty and released from that, not everyone presumably would believe that. Some people would think that he had done it still. So he was definitely a target, or we felt he was definitely a target, if someone had found his location. So the investigation went on further. Sort of the murder squad, kind of detectives became involved. And the locus, the scene was on, the crime scene was on for at least a week, I think, or so. And in that time, 24 hours a day, you have to have cops there. Well, now we come back to the midges. Remember that it's, high 20 degrees now, so pretty hot for Scotland. And you're now not allowed in the location. Trust me, you wouldn't want to go in there. It smelled so terrible. So you're having to basically wait outside the location. Now, sometimes you can wait in a vehicle in your car, and other times you can't. You'd have to physically stand outside the house. We'd already had press up there, from the papers sniffing around, trying to take photos. They'd got wind of who it was that had died in the address. So they were definitely sort of interested in and trying to get photos. A couple of our guys were approached and asked some questions and things, which clearly they weren't going to entertain. So it would pass over, you would have to go up there and spend some hours there. and formally take over this sort of crime scene log that you would record that you were now there, you know, and you had taken over the scene from this person. And when you finished, you know, it got passed to the next person who wrote in the book, you know, that they'd taken over. And anyone, any detectives or forensics or anyone else who'd, doctors, coroners, etc., that had come back and forth from the address, had to be recorded on that log. The problem is, while you're outside, that's where the midges were. And at different times of the day, dawn and dusk, particularly when there's no breeze, in these hot conditions near a water source like a lock, they come out. Now, Scottish midges, you know, they are without a doubt infamous. You know, if you look online, there's loads of YouTube videos of people getting pretty much torn apart. But when you actually see them, like if you had a midge in your hand, a single midge, you could barely see it. It's like a tiny black dot that you think couldn't cause you any problems at all. And even if you go these places where there's a lot of them, as there was at this location, you would find clouds and clouds of them. And you'd still think, to the untrained person, and I'd already had a couple of bad experiences, so I knew how bad they were. You'd think, well, they're just tiny. Now, they can't do me any harm. I don't see an issue. But what happens, and certainly to me, is if your hand or a piece of skin, you know, wherever it is, your leg, your knee, you know, your neck, whatever it is, gets exposed, a cloud of midges will descend on you and you'll see them on your skin, but you won't feel any bites or sort of anything like that. And they might just leave a tiny red dot. Certainly for me, and everyone's different, but for me, about 24 hours later, I would have, you know, a series of red dots on my hand, on my arm, or wherever they got me. But, and you'd think, oh, you know, certainly the first time it happened to me, I wasn't too worried. And I thought, well, that's fine. You know, they don't hurt, they don't itch, there's no problems at all. For me, what happens 24 hours later, the itching starts. Now, each one of those red dots, you know, is itchy. So you can imagine if you've got thousands, which is very easy to have thousands on you because there is so many, it is horrendous. The itching drives you crazy. And imagine it's all over you. And it got to the point where, even though it was so hot, we were standing outside. We didn't really have midge nets at that point, which are, as they sound, nets that basically fit over your head, almost like a pair of tights, like you're going to do a robbery, you know, an armed robbery in a bank. Like an old school London robber, you have this midge net over your head. We were having to wear gloves, and in the end, which you didn't have a midge net, we were using the spit hood. So when you get a suspect that comes into custody who's violent and fighting and spitting, you can put a midge net. You can put a spit hood over their head, which stops them spitting on you. You know, they only sort of spit within the mesh hood, and then they can't actually spit on you. We were having to put them on ourselves, have hats on, gloves, long sleeve jackets, you know, and this was all in, you know, 28 degrees or whatever. So it was a really unpleasant place to be. We were trying to rotate people round because, you know, you couldn't stand out there for like 6 hours. You were dehydrated, you couldn't drink. And the second somebody came up and said, hi, I'm, you know, Detective Inspector, whatever, and I need to get into the address. So you would take your hand out of your glove, get your pen out and start to write, you know, at 10:05 a.m., you know, Detective Inspector so-and-so arrived at the scene and went into the location. That was the, in that time, I'm looking at my hand through my midge net that's on my head and seeing my hand. I can barely see the skin on my hand because it's so black, because it's so covered in midges. That's how long it would take, seconds, when you were exposed for them to come in. And it was terrible. Really, really unpleasant place to work. Now, one thing that came out in the investigation, and this is possibly the comedy area, depending on your sense of humour. If you remember back to me throwing the stick for the cute doggy at the beginning, the detectives had a chat with like the local sergeant and various other people and said one thing they couldn't quite figure out was they'd found part of, I think it was one of the bones from the guy's arm out in the garden, and it took them a little while to figure it out. Then they realized that the dogs had been trapped in with the guy for some time, and they think that they had possibly been partially feeding off the guy to survive, you know, because he'd been dead for months and obviously no one was feeding them. They couldn't get out anywhere. He was potentially their only food source. And it then took me coming forward, and when I realized what happened, realized that the twig that I threw for the cute dog, and that we played, you know, tug of war with, and I threw for him a couple of times, was the unfortunate guy's arm bone that the dog had been gnawing on. And I'd been happily throwing his part of his arm bone, across the garden. So that helped explain that for sure. But you can imagine there was egg on my face. But how was I to know? Do you know what I mean? I was trying to stop this dog chomping me as I went in, so I was throwing, throwing a stick for the cute dog. But there we go. Once it was established what had happened, at least it sort of changed that. So the investigation carried on, and basically, he was so badly decomposed that they just couldn't find the cause of death in the end, and it went down to natural causes. And for me, like 95%, I believe that's probably the right conclusion. Almost certainly, he died of natural causes. But there's just 5% of me that thinks, with his background and the people, no doubt, that he made enemies of throughout his, criminal career, which is very well documented, there's every chance that perhaps someone had found him and that had murdered him at that location. And I'm not a conspiracy theorist or anything, but it is possible, because he was so far gone by the time we found him. That could have been what actually happened. But yeah, it went down to natural causes, and that was the end of that, because the investigation couldn't move forward any further in terms of medically, because of the state of him. Okay, so hopefully you found that interesting. Bit of an unusual one for sure, and as I say, certainly the worst one that I'd ever dealt with, and probably a lot of the cops there as well, I suspect. Yeah, it was a pretty gruesome scene. All right then, thanks very much for listening. Speak to you again soon. Take it easy. Cheers. Bye.